This is a crusade. This is a holy war against the deep state.
Where are the dictators? Where are the strong men?
Donald Trump is our instrument for retribution.
I'm going to fight for Christians. I'm going to fight for white people.
They have the Great Reset. We have the Great Awakening.
And why shouldn't I root for Russia?
Because I am.
I want to see these people go through misery because of their grooming against our children.
After the assailant entered the home asking, "Where's Nancy? Where's Nancy?" Those are the very same words used by the mob when they stormed the United States Capitol.
I did nothing wrong.
Welcome to the Did Nothing Wrong podcast, where we cut through the noise and help you make sense of the chaotic information space around us. I'm Griff Somke. Jacob Ware is a research fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, where he studies domestic and international terrorism and counterterrorism. He's also an adjunct professor in Georgetown University's Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service. Together with Bruce Hoffman, he is the author of God, Guns, and Sedition, Far-Right Terrorism in America. I'm thrilled to have him on the podcast today. Jacob, welcome to Did Nothing Wrong. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
So what made you decide that you wanted to do this kind of work?
Goodness, you know, I've always been interested in tactics and targeting especially. So I get very kind of geeky about almost the military aspects of terrorism and counterterrorism, right? What it looks like when somebody actually arrives on scene, the decisions they make, the decisions that counterterrorism forces make. And I remember getting very interested in this all the way back in like middle and high school. But specifically on the violent far right, I was 16 years old when a terrible terrorist attack happened in Norway, where first the white supremacist detonated a explosive device at the city's government quarter, and then he traveled to the nearby Utøya Island, which held the youth camp of the Norwegian Labour Party. I'm a Swedish citizen, and I was in Sweden at the time, and I think watching just the viciousness and the bloodthirstiness of that attack, targeting primarily children who really were just dreaming of a better world and wanting to make a difference in their communities, really struck me, and it never really left. And I was coming out of university, both undergrad and graduate school, right at the time that violent far-right extremism and far-right terrorism were starting to emerge as a major national security concern. And I felt I had something to contribute. And so our book project that I co-authored with Bruce Hoffman, who's a longstanding scholar of terrorism, started shortly after that.
You're the second person I've talked to who has cited that as kind of their spot where they got interested in this. One of our other guests a couple months ago was a guy named Bjorn Eiler, who was actually at the youth camp as a counselor the day that all went down. And he said that Breivik pulled the trigger on him, but the gun jammed. He was very much affected by that, and that was what made him go on to kind of devote his life to doing violence reduction work that he's been doing for the same purposes.
Yeah, Bjorn is part of the survivor community and has very courageously, I think, carried the torch forward. I'm not part of the extremism survivor community. I am a gun violence survivor, and I think I feel a duty to the cause for that reason. But it's interesting that you say that, Griff, because I'm based in Washington, D.C. And to be honest, when you walk around like the halls of any national security agency or even national security focused think tank here in D.C., you find just tons of people who will repeat the same kind of story of being driven to service by 9/11, right? They say that 9/11 happened and I felt it was my duty to drop everything and serve my country or contribute to the fight.
Right.
I'm not one of those people. I was a bit too young on 9/11, but I do feel that same calling based on the same desire to contribute to this battle that we're in.
Because it's gone way beyond one or two individual incidents, really. It's like there's a whole struggle for what feels like the liberal order, the rule of law that's gone on. Because the other side in this conflict very clearly wants that to fall. they've made it quite clear that they want what comes next.
Exactly. And I think, you know, watching how that has unraveled really my entire professional career from Charleston to Charlottesville to Pittsburgh to Christchurch, Poway, El Paso, Buffalo, Jacksonville, it is hard to watch that development and watch that unravel and not feel like you have a fight that you have to contribute to.
Right. Like if you can see it, if this is something that makes sense to you, you have to find a way to contribute to this.
Yeah, exactly right.
You mentioned that you wrote a book with Bruce Hoffman, and it's called God, Guns, and Sedition. It's about the white terrorist movement that we're talking about here in the United States and abroad. And it's a great overview of the history of this particular milieu as it takes the reader from the earliest days of the Ku Klux Klan all the way to the modern era. So from your research, are there any events that strike you as like real turning points in the overview of how this all went?
Yeah, I would say so. So let me first think about some of those events, and then I want to briefly think about the broader context. So three events that jump out straight away in my mind. 1978 and the publication of the Turner Diaries by William Luther Pierce, which really, I think, articulated a lot of these ideologies and strategies of violent far-right extremism in a novel that was accessible and widely read.
Right.
A lot of what we see today, I believe, has its roots in that book and in the movement it reflected. Second date, I would say, is 1995 and the bombing of the Oklahoma City Alfred Murrah Federal Building. Deadliest domestic terrorist act, modern domestic terrorist act in U.S. history, and really provided a marker, I think, on a lot of important developments, whether it's the ability of lone actors or small cells to conduct high-profile, very lethal attacks, or if it's the role that military veterans play in this movement, or the radicalizing power of the gun debate.
Right.
The third moment I would point to is the 2008 election of President Barack Obama. He received Secret Service protection earlier than any other candidate in U.S. history, codenamed Renegade, and really provided, I think, proof to those looking for it, to those inspired by what you might call replacement theory or the New World Order, that those tyrannical forces were taking control.
Right.
It inspired a huge rise in white supremacist activity and anti-government activity that I think contributed to a lot of those attacks that I've already mentioned. But one thing, Griff, that I'd like to touch on, if I may, because I think it tells a broader story that is really important here. We do trace back to the Reconstruction era and the Civil War and the roots of the KKK among veterans of the Confederacy.
Right.
But one thing I've identified, in not in this book, but in some other work I've done, which is really, I think, equal parts upsetting and unsurprising and daunting, is I came across one day the final speech that Frederick Douglass had given in his life. And in his final speech, which was posthumously published, Frederick Douglass spoke about the reasons why Black men were being lynched in the Reconstruction South. And the three reasons Frederick Douglass gave were Black men were lynched because of, you know, the allegation that they were diluting the white vote. So they were lynched to protect the white vote. They were lynched because of this narrative of protecting white women from rape, right, perpetrated by Black men in the South. And finally, they were lynched for a justification of preventing race riots. So those were the three reasons why Black men were lynched in the South, right? Protecting the white vote, protecting white women, protecting white communities from race riots. When you look at modern manifestos, and a lot of those incidents I already mentioned included manifestos, you actually see the exact same language, the exact same justifications in modern white supremacist terrorism. I mean, Dylann Roof,
right,
famously walked through the Mother Emanuel Church while he was murdering 9 Black parishioners and said, "I'm sorry, but you're raping our women and you have to go." That was a real wake-up call for me to see it spelled out that directly. And the reason I say this here, Griff, is we can point to individual moments in the trajectory of this movement and we can say, okay, these are the moments where they were accelerated or where the movement kind of came together around one cause, or this is the moment where they had a more compelling narrative. But the conspiracy theories and the justifications for violence are actually woven into the American story. And they go back to the Civil War and Reconstruction, at least. And so, yes, in our book, we point to some of those key moments. And we also raise a number of policy recommendations, which we think can target the violent edge of this movement. But there's also a real cultural issue here. And the conspiracy theories are not a fringe ideology. They are part of the American story. And at some point, you have to be able to reckon with that.
Right. So speaking of reckoning with that, in your book, you state that, quote, in this current usage, accelerationism is embraced by a spectrum of white supremacists, white nationalists, racists, anti-Semites, xenophobes, and anti-government militants as a clarion call to revolution. They fervently believe that the modern Western liberal state is so corrupt and inept that it is beyond redemption and must be destroyed in order to create a new society. Unquote. This actually seems to track quite well with the beliefs of some of the people on the extreme end of the left as well. In fact, accelerationism is actually a concept that goes back to Marx and Engels and the Communist Manifesto. Listening to the discourse on that side of the left, you will frequently hear that America is corrupt and evil and is too far gone to save. Do you think maybe that's part of the reason why this belief system seems to be catching on and accomplishing some of its goals?
Well, I definitely think there's a mutual radicalization that's going on. And there's kind of a meeting in the middle of anti-government and anarchist forces that both support that. There's almost a specific sentence that you see often, which says something on the lines of America is irredeemably blank, yeah, racist, corrupt. And if something is irredeemably broken, right, there's only one path forward. And as right-wing accelerationists often say, right, there is no political solution.
Correct.
You have to turn to these catastrophic acts of violence to try to spiral society out of control. It's a really interesting point you make, actually, comparing kind of that kind of sedition on both sides. I remember very early in the Biden administration, just to give you one example of you know, where I stand on that, I remember very early in the Biden administration, I thought that America was so divided that if I was the Chinese government, I would have invaded somewhere like Hawaii or Guam, not Taiwan.
Right.
For the simple reason that it was a perfect moment to, because if that happened, people on the right or the far right would say, well, Joe Biden is corrupt and inept, and this just shows that, you know, our country is in disarray and we told you we were right. Whereas people on the left would say, those foreign territories are evidence of lingering white supremacy and American colonialism, and it's right that they are being repurposed.
Absolutely. Absolutely, they would.
That didn't happen that China did that, right? But Russia did invade Ukraine at a time where I think they felt that we were very divided and that the United States would struggle to build up the unity both inside our borders and, you know, in NATO and the United Nations, for example, to respond to that. They miscalculated us, as I miscalculated. So maybe there is a side, there's an argument to make as these extremes of our society are, you know, running to even further to the extreme, there is also a strong center that is kind of trying its best to maintain, you know, sanity.
Right. And there's still red lines. There's still parts where people are going to look at something that happened and say, no, that's too far. That's too much.
Yeah.
And yeah. I think what you said about Russia's invasion of Ukraine was one of those red lines. Everybody who was watching that could kind of look and say, no,
yeah,
this is not something we're going to put up with.
Initially, at least. Although, can I offer one counter-argument? It's not a counter-argument. It's a counter-thought, which is, it's interesting how exactly what you're saying, those red lines are held to initially, but then can right, dissolve. I'm thinking of Ukraine and the battle we're having now in Congress, whether or not to fund it. But I'm also thinking of January 6th. In the immediate aftermath, right, there was a massive bipartisan rebuke.
Uh-huh.
And everybody was perfectly comfortable using the word that Bruce and I use, which is terrorism, to describe January 6th.
Mm-hmm.
Now we've circled back, you know, 3 years later to say, oh, the people who perpetrated that act were hostages and patriots and they're political prisoners and martyrs. So the red lines
get blurry after a while.
Can get blurry, yeah.
Yeah. And really, you're very right about that. Congress themselves, almost to a person, was very, I mean, even like your Mitch McConnells, your full on ideologue types were very, yeah. No, this is wrong. This should not have happened. But then as time goes by and narratives get set,
yeah,
it becomes less of a clear condemnation and more of a, well, they were just trying to take back what they see as an unjust. Yeah.
Yeah.
So one of the reasons why we got to that point where we go from 3 years ago, this is very clear what happened. Everybody watched it in real time. Everybody saw it and said, no, this is wrong. To now there's so much equivocation about it is social media.
Mm-hmm.
Social media has made it possible to spread really, really great things, but also really terrible ideas in speeds. No one comprehended that we'd be able to do this 10, 15 years ago. Do you feel that this has helped amplify some of these accelerationist narratives well beyond what anybody had comprehended that these could do?
I think the story of social media and its impact on extremism and terrorism is a story of lowered barriers to entry, both ideologically and tactically. So ideologically, I think we're seeing a shift when these ideologies can be brought to people. So, you know, for the first, 130 years that Bruce and I cover in our book, violent far-right extremism typically involved, you know, in-person
right.
meetings in places like, you know, Hayden Lake, Idaho, and Estes Park, and what have you. That has shifted now. And so I think what that means for ideology is we're seeing some of the rigidity and the tradition of certain ideologies and conspiracy theories be blurred, to use a word that you used earlier,
right,
allowing others to kind of pick it up and run with it in ways that appeal more to their personal grievances. Tactically, this is another story where we see in the past, I would say 10 to 15 years, a lot of the acts of violence that we see are perpetrated by younger people, often driven by a range of personal vulnerabilities, whether it's mental health issues or history of being bullied. And they're able to conduct attacks on their own using often very crude weaponry, which can include firearms in the United States, and targeting soft targets that are defined by their accessibility. And that changes your counterterrorism response. I think one example of a movement that really exemplifies this very well is QAnon. Both of these movements. QAnon is what I would call a mass radicalization movement. And social media has allowed that movement to pick up on what really are, in some cases, centuries-old anti-Semitic conspiracy theories about things like, right, a small cabal of elites who are controlling various elements of society, and also the blood libel conspiracy theory that this elite is drinking the blood of you know, the worthy and the good people.
Right.
It's repackaged those conspiracy theories and brought them to a massive scale. And then on the tactical side, people have picked that up and conducted very bizarre, low-level, random, chaotic acts of terrorism, like one that happened here in my hometown, I think in 2016, when somebody opened fire at a pizzeria, believing that there were children in the basement that were being controlled by this democratic sex trafficking.
Right. Pizzagate,
exactly. So social media, I think, has just opened up extremism to a whole new range of constituents who no longer have to radicalize as far ideologically and no longer have to be as well-trained tactically to really impact this space.
And you mentioned Pizzagate, and that's interesting. We've covered that extensively. And the reason we've covered it extensively is because it was this one kind of crew of bad actors who started that and pushed it. And that was one of their very early tactical successes, I think, in this war, was being able to get people to pick up on this story that when you look at it is ludicrous. You look at it as somebody who isn't, you know, stuck in this belief system, and you're like, no, they're not doing that. There's no basement in this place. They're not, you know, hiding children in the basement. Come on, this is ridiculous. But they know how to talk to the people that they want to talk to. And you've got to the point where post a video showing up yourself at the place, trying to ask them about this and then getting turned away. one of their people shows up with a gun 2 weeks later. It really has made those narratives easy for any bad actor to pick up and convince people to go do something worse with it.
And I think it makes counterterrorism very difficult because, in theory, you know, defensive counterterrorism will usually focus on, you know, high profile sites, right, and harder targets. But in theory, if you believed that you were in a situation where there was a particularly high threat to, let's say, Jewish communities, theoretically, you could protect every synagogue in the country. Now, it's not a, you know, that's not a good thing because it basically shows that you think there's an inevitability of violence that you can't prevent. But you could do that.
Yeah.
You can't protect every pizzeria in the country with armed police. And by the way, even if you did that, when you look at some of the other targets of QAnon violence, like the New York Mafia and the Hoover Dam and hospital ships during COVID,
right,
you actually have an incredibly broad range of would-be targets that makes counterterrorism really difficult because you actually don't know where they're going to show up.
Yeah, you would need like a team constantly monitoring their forums, their chats, their Telegram channels, listening to what the narrative is, and to be real-time deploying these security assets to whatever they're mad about now.
Correct. And it's made a lot more difficult by, you know, our First Amendment regulations, which say that the majority of that rhetoric, right, almost all of it, is not actually illegal.
Right.
So the best you can do is hope to prevent an attack. But when you've got that kind of broad range of targets, that is borderline impossible.
Right. So one of the reasons this is so hard is, and you mentioned this in the book as well, that the accelerationists are organized around the principles of leaderless resistance. And that's the title of an essay written by a man named Louis Beam. Beam seems to have been right next to almost every incident of white supremacist terror, from the bank robberies of the Order to the bombing of the Murrah Federal Building in 1995. But he seems to get far less attention than, say, James Mason, who wrote Siege. And Beam was a much more prominent member of the movement, even though they were both kind of prominent in the same era. But he gets overlooked a lot. Why do you think that is?
Excellent question. I don't have a good answer for you because I agree with the premise of the question. There's a really interesting, you know, kind of to contextualize this a little bit, and I'm copying some of my co-author Bruce's earlier analysis. He wrote an article on this in War on the Rocks after the Christchurch shooting, and we expand on it in the book. In terrorism and counterterrorism, there's this misunderstanding, I would say. We think that the Islamic State in the middle of the 2010s pioneered arguably the two most important terrorist innovations of this century. That is social media radicalization and lone actor violence. Both of those strategies were used to great effect by the Islamic State in inspiring acts of violence from San Bernardino, California, to Orlando, Florida, to London, Stockholm, Berlin, Barcelona, and beyond. But we trace those innovations, both the social media radicalization and lone act of violence or leaderless resistance, to Beam in the 1980s and 1990s. We actually write in our book that he's arguably the only person who's had a bigger impact on this movement than Beam is William Pierce, who wrote the Turner Diaries. Those two innovations have had an incredible impact on the movement, and they continue today. I mean, you just need to look down that list of attacks I've mentioned, or the list of individuals: Breivik, Roof,
right,
Bowers, Crucius, Tarrant, Ernest, Gendron. They are making use of social media radicalization. They're making use of leaderless resistance, which is allowing these lone actor violence, acts of lone actor violence, without the leadership of the movement ever being held really accountable for them. It's devastatingly effective. And it's part of the reason, A, why we have such a tough time trying to counter this violence. And it's B, part of this, you know, it's the reason why Louis Beam has had such a lasting influence.
Right. I mean, one of his biggest contributions to the white supremacist cause was something called Aryan Nations Liberty Net, which was a bulletin board system, or BBS. And for those of you who aren't as old as me, BBSs were how people connected computers together before the internet became ubiquitous. It was a dial-up. You would call, you would use an old 300 baud modem to connect to the main computer that was running the software, and you would be able to leave messages for and talk to other like-minded folks. Beam saw this as the future because they could screen who was using it, and the government couldn't listen in unless they had the credentials to get on. And if they controlled access quite tightly, which they did, they would have something where they could plot and they could talk about the things that they wanted to do and not have to worry about the feds listening in. And if you think of him as not only the guy who pioneered the accelerationism idea of we're going to make it look like a bunch of lone wolves, or we're going to tell people that's what's going on, but everybody knows the plan. Everybody knows what we're trying to achieve here. Don't ask, just go do it. And the idea that we can use the computer technology to talk to each other, those two things make him so incredibly influential on what we're looking at now. It's just almost scary when you look at it.
And that was, I think, back in the early 1980s, right?
Yeah, that was 1984 when he came up with LibertyNet. And yeah. I mean, if you think about it, there weren't a whole lot of bulletin board systems even in 1984. The internet was strictly academic. There was no World Wide Web. And the idea that somebody might be doing something nefarious with this technology wasn't even on law enforcement's radar. There's a fascinating book out from that era called The Cuckoo's Egg. It's about a guy named Cliff Stoll, who was an admin at the computer lab at Lawrence Livermore. And he found an accounting error that he finally traced down, like a time error for which lab was using enough time. And he finally traced it down to a German hacker who was working for the KGB. And it took him years to get anybody in law enforcement to actually acknowledge that this was a problem. And meanwhile, they've gotten into the computers at Lawrence Livermore, which is one of America's like national defense laboratories. So this is one of those that he was so far ahead. The idea that this would be something that would be this useful. I'm really surprised this guy's managed to stay out of jail, to be honest.
Do you know, the remarkable thing too is everything you described there in terms of what the strategy was. You know, we can use this technology, we can hide from prying eyes, we can communicate with each other, we can plan attacks, we can exchange best practices. The strategic reasoning behind it hasn't really changed.
Nope.
Right? This is still the reason why these extremists are using 8chan and Gab and Telegram and Discord, right? It's still the same reasons, except Beam had understood that in 1983 and 84.
Yeah.
Like, it's actually pretty remarkable.
Yeah. And in 1987, Beam and other white supremacist leaders were put on trial in Fort Smith, Arkansas, for seditious conspiracy. And they were acquitted, but it cost them a lot of money, and it drew quite a bit of publicity that they didn't want to some of their more nefarious activities. How do you think that trial influenced Beam's thinking about movement tactics going forward?
It influenced them heavily. I mean, he was acquitted in 1988, and almost immediately he went underground a little bit, and he started up a magazine or a journal, very cleverly named The Seditionist. And in 1992, he, I guess, reincarnated a strategy of terrorism and insurgency known as leaderless resistance, right? This concept that we're going to organize in small cells or as individuals with little, you know, centralized direction, little communication between the cells in order to avoid, you know, being infiltrated.
Right.
I think there are some really interesting parallels between the 1998 Fort Smith trial and the 2001 to, I guess, 2004 January 6th trials, because the fact that the seditious conspiracy charges were unsuccessful in 1988 had two impacts. One, it really scared the government away from using this tool. B, it sent a movement, a message to the movement that, you know, you need to be careful, but the kind of organizing you're doing, the kind of overthrow of the government that you're allegedly advocating, is not actually criminal, and it's somewhat safe. Now, some really interesting stuff happened on January 6th, where you have, on the one hand, these groups who are operating very publicly, carrying insignias, known leadership, known finances, known communications, groups like the Oath Keepers,
right,
the Proud Boys, Three Percenters. And then you also have this network, right? This leaderless resistance mindset that the Beam had advocated for. And you know what happened? The groups that operated publicly on January 6th, their leaders were arrested and sentenced on those seditious conspiracy charges that the government had failed with in 1988. The network, the people in that leaderless resistance, the ones who showed up outside of groups, the ones who did not reveal themselves as publicly, they were largely sentenced, but they got far less serious crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think January 6th actually is almost proof of concept for Beam's initial lessons learned after Fort Smith and the reasons why he wrote Leaderless Resistance, right? If you operate under the radar, if you operate in small cells, networks, individually, you can be relatively protected from government infiltration. It's when you operate in groups and you're showing off your organizational capacity and you're showing off your insignias, that's when you leave yourself really vulnerable to these to government informants and government infiltration.
And you mentioned this in the book. You talk about how some of the groups that started up after the election of Trump, groups like the Adam Waffen Division, were very big on their aesthetic and their branding, and as a result, were very susceptible to informers and people who were infiltrating these groups in order to get information on what they were up to. And pretty much all of the initial members of that group ended up going to jail. The same thing that happened with the Base, which was the group that Ronaldo Nazzaro started. They were very big on their logos, their iconography, and same thing happened. They got an informant in the group. People ended up going to jail as a result of that. Where Beam's whole point was, you don't want a group that's any bigger than two or three or four people. You know, people you absolutely know you can trust at all times, because anything bigger than that, and they will be able to get a Fed into the group.
Yeah. Yeah, the Base is a especially interesting point, because I think they were operating with, you know, entry standards. They screened people coming in, and they thought they had really good operational security. Well, both journalists and the FBI got in.
Yeah.
So evidently the operational security was lacking. And they got blown up, right? They got completely taken apart. And again, I think the Oath Keepers and Proud Boys, the lessons that they're taking from January 6th is the same that the Adam Waffen Division and the Base will take. And it's the same one, again, that Lewis Beam understood back in 1988.
Yeah.
You need to be deeper underground. You cannot reveal yourselves in these organized networks, because they will come for you and they will break you up.
Yeah. Yeah, and he's been proven to be correct on that, because that is sort of the song of their people. If you look at it, every single time a group like this has gotten started, whether it's been an outright white terrorist group like the Base, like Adam Waffen, or even a lot of the more, like, not overtly racist, but definitely anti-government groups like the militias in the 90s, the groups that like Ammon Bundy put together to go to the Malheur Wildlife Refuge and try to take that over, they were riddled with feds. There were people in those groups who were informing the entire time. And it just makes it so much clearer that that's not a tenable strategy past a certain point for these guys.
And again, from a pure counterterrorism standpoint, we've had a really tough time with lone actors who are breaking off of these networks, breaking off of these online platforms, and committing acts of violence and not even revealing who they are until they're arrested.
Right.
We saw that at Buffalo, Charleston, Pittsburgh, El Paso. We don't have a great response to that. We have got a very good response to the groups. We don't have a good response to the leaderless resistance mentality. It is, objectively, it is very effective.
Right. And the recruitment of people into these groups, watching how, say, something like the Terrorgram network got started, where you have people putting out this propaganda and just churning it out with no expectation that people really have to join this group, just putting out piece after piece of aesthetic propaganda and hoping that someone's going to pick up on this and almost self-radicalize as a result. That seems to be the play now. And like you said, it's very hard to stop.
It is. We have a relatively permissive environment in this country, I think, partly because of the First Amendment, partly because of the very, very long leash that we've given to social media companies to be in control of their own content standards. And I think the extremist groups have figured out where those gaps in our response are, and they've really doubled down on those gaps, like our lack of social media moderation, like algorithms. They're very effective at using those to spread the word.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And they're very effective at figuring out which social media platforms are like the battleground and which social media platforms are almost like where you retreat to. Because like looking at it from outside, it looks like, say, for instance, Twitter. I'm not calling it X. Don't care. Twitter is the battleground. Telegram is where they're planning these attacks and launching them. 4chan, where they're planning these attacks and launching them. And they've figured out how to put things together off-site for some of these social media groups and then launch these things fully, almost formed, when they decide they're going to.
That's a fascinating point, and I think really important. And it speaks to a mistake that I think a lot of us working in counterterrorism are making, where we think that radicalization kind of happens relatively linearly on a social media platform. So we use language like he radicalized on 8chan or he radicalized on Telegram. After the Buffalo shooting, the New York State Attorney General's office, I think, released a report where at one point they made this fascinating list of the ways that that shooter had used different social media platforms at different stages of his radicalization and for different purposes. So they spoke about the social media platforms where he was learning about his guns.
Right.
They spoke about where he was getting his ideology. They spoke about the fact that he was keeping a diary on Discord. They spoke about the fact that he live streamed, I think, on Twitch.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not even, you're exactly right. They know that different places are different battlegrounds, but they also know that the different social media platforms can be used for different purposes. And that just helps them evade further, right? Because it's they're spreading out their presence more thin. And it's really difficult to pick up on that.
Yeah. And it's the tools that you need to do the job, as one of my favorite movies, the guy said. Discord isn't a great way to, you know, mass radicalize people necessarily, but it's great for getting together with your friends and talking things through. You know, same with Telegram. Twitter isn't necessarily a great place to hang out with your friends. But if you're trying to get a message out and you're trying to get people worldwide to pay attention to a point that you're trying to make, I still don't think there's anything superior.
There's a way that radicalization happens both deeply and broadly. So Twitter, I think, is where you can reach a really broad audience with a conspiracy theory. But if you go too extreme on the conspiracy theory, right, you leave yourself vulnerable to that moderation. Well, so you reach a broader audience on Twitter. Meanwhile, you're going much deeper into the ideology on Telegram.
Somewhere else. Yeah, absolutely. And you're researching your guns on Reddit or on 4chan.
Yeah, but your memoir, your diary is on Discord.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And you're preparing to use Twitch on the day. And that's very difficult because we have this mindset that each individual social media company, you know, is responsible for their moderation. And if we just ask them all to deal better with the extremists in their midst, the problem will be solved. Well, when in reality, the extremists are one step ahead. They know that they've got fingers in multiple pies trying to figure out how they can each use each platform for their own advantage.
I mean, you look at the guy who shot up the mall recently in Texas, and he had used the very obscure Russian social media site to dump a lot of his stuff simply because he knew that no one was looking.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the kind of thing anybody's going to be randomly trawling and see and say, oh, great, that's not good. But they've learned to use the tools, and that's terrifying.
That's another case, by the way, to my earlier point of somebody with just a bizarre and chaotic and unrestrained ideology, combining, if you could even call it an ideology, right? Combining elements of white supremacy with personal grievance, with incel mindset,
right?
Then manifesting in an attack that you can't really tell that there's any direct political motive. Certainly there didn't seem to be anything political about the targets, or ideological about the targets. So Yeah, another one of that's just, I actually think that's a really good case study in terms of modern extremism and how hard it is to really get your hands around these individual cases, both because of how effectively they're using platforms, how chaotic they are, their targeting is, and also just how eclectic some of these ideologies are. I mean, they're not ideologies, right? Because they're so personalized, but at the same time, they incorporate all these various political elements into one individualized ideology that is sufficient for some people to drive them towards that act of violence.
Sure. I saw it referred to as cafeteria conspiracy at one point, where you can just grab, say you're into chemtrails and you're into QAnon to some extent, and you also believe that kids are being turned transgender, and you can put together enough of this stuff to, like you said, give yourself a justification for going after anybody you feel is worth going after. And it does look on the outside like a lone wolf.
Yeah.
But in reality, a lot of the time it isn't. And do you think people are finally starting to realize at least a lot of the white supremacist terrorism is not really a lone wolf thing? It's actually more of a long-term strategy. It's been planned for a while.
Yeah, I think so. Although I have unique views on this issue, because I think you do have to differentiate between the strategic level and the operational level, to use military parlance. At the strategic level, you're absolutely right. Right, there is a broader network. There's a broader movement. It's organized to some extent. The ideology is widespread, and the violence is planned.
Right.
Operationally, though, when it comes down to that individual act in that individual place, you are still largely talking about, you know, lone actors, lone wolves, for lack of a better term. There's almost different jobs for different categories of people, right? As I said at the start, there is a political fight on our hands to deal with white supremacy in our country. And that's cultural. It's deeply embedded. It requires a reckoning. And that will be needed to deal with the network of organized, deliberate white supremacy and organized and deliberate white supremacist terrorism in this country.
Right.
At the same time, you need law enforcement and intelligence agencies to be sensitive to how effective leaderless resistance and lone actor terrorism is, why it's so effective at targeting soft targets that really are just community spaces, whether a place of worship or a supermarket, and how you can better protect those sites or try and get upstream in the radicalization process. So I do think there's nuance, and that is what makes it so challenging, right? This is a multi-pronged problem, and we need a multi-pronged response.
Right. And you have a chapter in the book where you talk about potential solutions to the violent extremism problem. And one of the things that you suggest is new domestic terrorism legislation. Walk me through what that would look like, and how does it avoid the inevitable confrontation with the First Amendment?
Well, Griff, I resent that question because I'm an ideas man. I need a lawyer to answer that question. It's a really interesting recommendation. I think there are a few people in our field that talk about it, but it's probably the one recommendation in our book that we get pushback primarily from the left. And the reasoning for that is this fear that it's going to be weaponized by an authoritarian right-wing presidency to designate, you know, Antifa or Black Lives Matter as domestic terrorists. That would also run into those First Amendment concerns, of course, but it is something that we think about and we take on board. The reason why, just briefly, why we talk about domestic terrorism laws is twofold. So the first thing is we don't have domestic terrorism legislation in this country, but we do have terrorism legislation for foreign terrorists.
Right.
And I'm using that word deliberately because the legislation relates to what's called a foreign terrorist organization as designated by the State Department. So let's take ISIS, which is an FTO, as an example. The ISIS terrorism cases averaged about 13 and a half years jail sentences.
Right.
So first, there's an optics problem. There's an optics problem of we are calling people of a different religion and usually a different race terrorists when we're not calling white supremacists who often commit far more violent acts as terrorists. So that's a problem. The second issue is sentencing equity and recidivism. So very frequently, law enforcement who think they are tracking a plot don't have any real cases to use. So there's no terrorism case, and maybe there shouldn't be. But that often means that they use whatever they can to get somebody off the street. There was a case just recently in Texas of an individual who they believed was plotting an attack on migrants. And so they had to infiltrate somebody to sell, to buy an unregistered silencer from him to get him off the street.
Right.
Those cases usually involve sentences of like 1 year. A good example of this is Brandon Russell, who founded the Adam Roffen Division that we spoke about earlier. Brandon was arrested, I think, in 2017 or 2018 for explosive, stockpiling explosive materials, and law enforcement believed they'd stopped a terrorist attack. Brandon was sentenced to 5 years in prison, and he was actually released early.
Mm-hmm.
And last year, he was rearrested for plotting to attack power stations around Baltimore, trying to black out the city and start a race war for accelerationist purposes.
The minute he got out, he got a girlfriend and he got a co-conspirator, and they started plotting to blow up power stations around Baltimore. It's amazing what a great job of rehabilitation we did with him.
Exactly. So that means the status quo, in our opinion, is unsatisfactory on domestic terrorism legislation. So that doesn't mean that we ignore those counterarguments. And the two big ones are the weaponization of the First Amendment. So here's how we try to get around those. On the weaponization front, New York State has a domestic terrorism statute at the state level. It was used against the Buffalo shooter. The way that they have protected that law is, they do have guardrails, and I think the guardrails are on lethality and scale. So I believe it has to be a lethal act, has to have more than 5 casualties. So that wouldn't be useful in the Brandon Russell case, right?
Right.
But it's an example of how different places are thinking about how do you make sure that it doesn't get weaponized. And so we'd want to continue that conversation. On the First Amendment side, again, you would focus on violence. So it is not illegal. It's First Amendment protected to be a white supremacist in this country.
Mm-hmm.
It's First Amendment protected to be, you know, a jihadist in theory. It's First Amendment protected to be a militant anarchist in your rhetoric. What is not protected is to be violent on behalf of those ideologies. And so if you are violent, right, you do have a suite of legal measures that can be used against you, whether it's conspiracy or murder, for example. So domestic terrorism statute doesn't need to get into ideology. It doesn't need to get into the First Amendment space. It can hang out in that violence space where there's much less controversy, right? If somebody has killed somebody on behalf of a political ideology, First Amendment is not going to protect them anymore.
Right. Right.
Again, I'm not a lawyer, but they have broken the law. And so whether or not we add an additional law on top of that, as you would with the material support to foreign terrorist organization statute, I don't think really gets into the First Amendment. Yes, you would run into trouble if you try to designate groups as domestic terrorist groups. And we don't advocate for designations. It would be horribly messy.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it would be weaponized and you would run headfirst into that First Amendment wall, as you should, frankly. But these individual cases like Charleston, Pittsburgh, El Paso, Buffalo, it is unacceptable that cases of jihadist terrorism, like the New York City van ramming, involve terrorism statutes, but the Buffalo shooting, for example, does not involve a federal terrorism statute. Frankly, it's just a remnant of white supremacy. And it sends that message as well to the targeted communities that this form of violence against our community on behalf of, you know, due to our race, it's murder, sure, but it's not considered terrorism by the country. That's a problem.
It absolutely is, because people do, like you said, see that and they get the message. They understand that they are not worthy on some level of the same protections, that
they are less than.
Yeah. And this is where you find yourself wanting to say there's got to be a way that if your stated goal involves knocking down the system and you do something like this, then maybe that's when you catch the enhancement.
Yeah.
If your particular act involves violence and you talk about, you know, I did this for this particular reason, then it's pretty hard to make the argument that that guy's not a terrorist.
Yeah, absolutely.
I wonder if there's something you could do about guys like Beam, though. I mean, he was on the FBI's 10 most wanted list at one point in his youth, but he's figured out how not to be the guy actually holding the gun or the guy parking the Ryder truck. You know, he's figured out how to stay himself a little ways away from that. And that's the part that, like, I find myself wanting to say, they can always get another Timothy McVeigh. They can always get another Brenton Tarrant. Those guys are pretty easy. There are a lot of guys like that. There aren't a lot of Louis Beams. How do you get to the point where you can start addressing that? And I know there's no good answer to this. I absolutely know that. I'm kind of thinking out loud here. But it seems that foot soldiers are always easy to find in any war, any conflict. You can always find foot soldiers. But finding talented military genius generals, that's a lot harder. What's Beam doing now? Do we know?
I don't know.
Do you think he's still involved?
I would be interested to ask him what he sees and what he thinks about some of the violence that we've seen over the past 10 to 15 years. I imagine that he would try to put everything at an arm's length, you know, mm-hmm. in order to protect himself, like you mentioned. But he must understand that we are reaping what he has sown in our country.
Mm-hmm.
Whether he looks at that with pride or whether he looks at that with fear, I don't know, but it would be interesting to get an answer from him.
Sure would. So how can people support you in the work that you're doing?
That's such a kind question. Well, I post all my work on Twitter, not X.
Yeah.
And trying to get set up on Blue Sky as well. We fellows at my think tank have profile pages, and I try to keep that updated with all the recent work. But to be honest, I would be really honored if, you know, your listeners would consider picking up a copy of our book, God, Guns, and Sedition, Far-Right Terrorism in America. It talks about everything that you and I have spoken about today. And my co-author and I have really poured our blood, sweat, and tears into it to try to tell a story mm-hmm. about white supremacy, anti-government extremism, sedition in this country, and tie it back to some of the founding principles of our nation. Everything that I could possibly say on this pretty much is in those pages.
Right.
So,
and we barely scratched the surface here. The book is almost 500 pages. It's amazing. I am three quarters of the way through this book right now. And it's just, yeah, this is one of the better books I've read on this subject. And it's definitely a must read. We will be linking to this in the show notes. So if you're looking for some light summer reading, this is probably not what you're looking for, but you should read it anyway.
That's so kind, Griff. And I'll just say to your loyal listeners that obviously you have my email address.
Right.
Griff, and anybody who has any questions or wants to discuss any of this further, I'm more than happy to be in contact. So feel free to reach out.
Excellent. The book is called God, Guns, and Sedition. Jacob, thank you for taking the time to come on with me today. I really appreciate it. It's been enlightening, and you guys are doing great work over there. So please keep it up.
We'll talk to you again. You're doing great work as well. Thank you for having me.
No problem. Take care. Thanks for listening to the Did Nothing Wrong podcast. If you want to hear more, you can find us on the web at didnothingwrongpod.com. Please make sure you subscribe to get our content straight into your inbox. You can also follow us on Twitter at GrizzaBJJ, GrzaBJJ, as well as DNWPod. We're extremely grateful for paid subscriptions and donations that allow us to keep doing this important work. Thanks, and remember, everyone mentioned did nothing wrong.